The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it is my pleasure to welcome our guests. Our theme tonight could be described as everything you always wanted to know about reality but were afraid to ask because you wouldn't understand the answers anyway. Well, tonight you just might. Our first presenter, Dave Goldberg, is a former table tennis champion and Gibbs lecturer at Yale University, where he created the Yo Mama program for the Yale Observatory. Today, he's a professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Physics at Drexel University, where he has an interest in extracting information out of weak and strong lensing signals of galaxy clusters. He is the author of several books, and he joins us tonight to present his ideas from his latest, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. The journal Nature describes the book this way: who knew symmetry could be so brilliantly entertaining? Physicist Dave Goldberg slings the reader straight in at the deep end of this big physics concept, but with enough masterly wit to keep you afloat. Dave will be joined by Max Tegmark, physics professor at MIT, a self-confessed mouse hunter, lover of poetry, and the co-author or author of more than 200 technical papers. A master of multiverses, he's here to present his first book, Our Mathematical Universe, My Quest for the Ultimate Nature of Reality. In another review from Nature, Andrew Lydell writes, "This is a valuable book, written in a deceptively simple style, but not afraid to make significant demands on its readers, especially once the multiverse level gets turned up to 4. It's impressive how far Tegmark can carry you until, like a cartoon character running off a cliff, you wonder whether there is anything holding you up." Time to fasten your seatbelts. Please welcome our first presenter, Dave Goldberg.
So thank you for that great introduction. Welcome. Hopefully we will do as much as we can to tell you about the nature of the universe and still leave you feeling comfortable living in it, that you're not building up your existence on an infinite series of turtles. Andy, I think, did a masterly job joining these two books together. I'm going to be giving you sort of a description of how mathematical symmetries shape the universe, how we understand the universe to work, and how it's based on some very, very simple concepts at its core. And then I'm going to conclude. I'm sorry to start off by giving you my conclusions, but why not? I'm going to conclude with a bunch of statements along the lines of, yeah, but we really don't know where a lot of these things come from. And then Max is going to tell you that, in fact, he does. So The premise of the talk is why symmetry matters. And so I start off with a quote by Phil Anderson, the Nobel laureate. It's only slightly overstating the case to say that the study of physics is the study of symmetry. And I'm sorry to start off with Webster's dictionary defines symmetry as, so I'll do a little bit better and quote the mathematician Hermann Weyl, which is to say, a thing is symmetrical if there's something you can do to it so that after you finish doing it, it looks the same as it did before. Which seems pretty obvious. I mean, there's symmetric objects that you are very familiar with. Here's a very simple example, an equilateral triangle. You can rotate it by a third of a turn, or you can reflect it, and it looks exactly the same as it did before. This is pure math, and of course I'm a physicist, so we're presumably going to want to delve a little bit deeper. But in motivating all of this, I want to just point out, we find symmetry in nature, we find symmetry in architecture that humans produce, things that people find beautiful, even the puzzles that we produce. So American-style crossword puzzles, for example, are designed in such a way that they need to either have a reflection symmetry, that is to say, you can flip the white, the black and white squares in a mirror, and they'll look the same as it did before, or rotate it 180 degrees, and it'll look the same as it did before. All part of what makes these things sort of interesting-looking puzzles, hard to construct, and they appeal to our minds. In the lower right, you see a prototypical grand design spiral galaxy, where you could basically rotate the thing around 180 degrees, it looks the same as it did before. In nature, in art, in architecture, it shows up all the time. And you might simply say, yes, well, that's very beautiful, but does it mean anything? And that's a fair question. So I want to start with sort of a simple example of a symmetrical object, or a very nearly symmetrical object that you're probably familiar with, one that gave rise to sort of our understanding of how genetics and inheritance really works, and that is to say the double helix of DNA. This object is symmetric in a very real sense. I can twist it any old way, and it will still retain the basic properties that it did before. But there's a very important aspect to this particular example, which is to say the double helix only spirals in a particular way. It spirals in such a way that the strands go counterclockwise if they're spiraling toward you, and not clockwise. Every helix of DNA looks the same way, spirals the same way. And in fact, this turns out to be just a consequence of history, but it's one that's shared by all living things on Earth. It is, in fact, an argument that all living things on Earth have common ancestor, have common DNA, because nothing goes the other way. Now, this is why this is sort of a launching point for me, because here you've got this object that has a beautiful symmetry to it, but what really gives it some of its power is the fact that there's a symmetry breaking, that there's something that is asymmetric about it. So that's going to be a very common theme. That's also 100% of everything I know about biology, so please don't ask any follow-up questions about how DNA works. So let's start with mathematics. So there's a subsample, maybe in this elite crowd, the sample might be quite small, who will recognize these things not for the geometric objects they are, but for the dice in Dungeons & Dragons. There is one missing, by the way, and I'll be impressed to know if anybody can identify which of the standard dice set in Dungeons & Dragons is missing out of this. You just yell it out, I'll be... Well, there we go. That's the sort of crowd we're dealing with. It's the 10-sided die is missing, and it is not, in fact, one of these Platonic solids. This is the complete set of objects that where basically every face is identical, with no different faces. These are the Platonic solids. The only one that's sort of missing is the infinite-sided Platonic solid, which is to say the sphere. In case you're curious, the 10-sided die, as you might know it, is known as an anti-die pyramid. So there you go. There's your little factoid for the day. These objects are beautiful in their own right and turn out to play an interesting role in sort of our history of understanding how symmetry was understood in the physical sciences. And we'll see a cool example of that. So this was an original design of Kepler's. So Johannes Kepler is very famous for, among other things, profiting from the death of his boss Tycho Brahe, at which point he stole all of Tycho's data, and basically tried to map out how the planets moved around the solar system. And so, I mean, Kepler was a great mathematician. Tycho was an outstanding observer. This was the time before telescopes. You know, this is 400 years ago. And Kepler basically tried to mix and match every old way, and he said, I've got this beautiful approach. At the time, there were 6 known planets. There were 5 Platonic solids plus the sphere. He said, 6 planets, 6 shapes. If I just embed them in a cosmological turducken, I can basically come up with a model of the solar system that exploits this beautiful symmetry to figure out how far each planet should be from the sun. This is a model of the solar system. And he wasn't the first to try to use this idea that symmetric things should play an important role in how we understand the universe. You may know that we were stuck in park for a while in our understanding of how things work by Aristotle and many of his contemporaries, who believed, you know, that the Earth was at the center of the solar system and that there was a giant sphere surrounding us, because of course where the stars were taped, basically, and all the planets were also on spheres, because spheres were so obviously beautiful. They were the greatest, most symmetric objects that there were. He was wrong. Aristotle was wrong. Kepler was wrong with this model. Kepler ultimately realized that the planets move around in elliptical orbits. It is an interesting sort of historical side note to note that the only reason he didn't come up with an ellipse sooner is he's like, well, that was pretty obvious. I mean, I thought if it was that obvious, somebody would have come up with it first. But they were on the right sort of track. It turns out that In understanding how symmetry plays in the universe, it's not just that things look like giant crystals or beautifully symmetric objects on sort of the cosmic scales. It turns out that the laws of physics themselves are governed by incredibly simple symmetries from which you get all of the physical laws that you hated memorizing in high school and college. So let me give you some examples. So physical laws obey some symmetries. And what I mean by that is you can change, remember Weyl's definition, you can change something and yet something else remains the same. So for example, some things don't matter. Some things are symmetric. You can teleport yourself or you can go into suspended animation for a billion years, wake up, and if you're a physicist, you could just resume your work as it was before. The laws of physics remain the same. The laws of physics remain the same regardless of how your apparatus is oriented, except for local effects, of course. You know, here on Earth, there's magnetic fields, but that's just because of the Earth. That's not because of how things actually work. You could go a million light years away, run your experiment, and the results should be exactly the same. They should tell you exactly the same things about the universe. Those things don't matter. There are some things that do matter, and one very good example is physical scale. So, you know, there's a rich sci-fi and kids movie trope about this idea that there might be some tiny civilization that's basically atom-sized where their world is very rich, or maybe we're basically just an atom in some bigger creature's chemistry set, you know, and we're just some tiny atom or some living on some molecule in that, you know, and let's be honest, I mean, you might not entirely be in your... You might be in your more speculative mode in a college dorm late at night, and we'll just leave it at that, when you start having those sorts of conversations. Physical scale does seem to matter. And in fact, it really matters when you get to very, very small scales, because on very, very small scales, you start hitting the effects of quantum mechanics, where you encounter things like uncertainty and wave functions and things like that, that end up giving a very, very different sense of reality than the concrete causal feeling reality that we have on our large Human scales. I'll give you one of the first people to discuss this was Galileo. Galileo was this genius of the first order, but he decided, you know, he's smart enough that he can spend his time speculating on whether or not the biblical accounts of giants made any sense. So he started asking the question, you know, if I took a human being of the exact same design and scaled them up tenfold in every direction, you know, much like in Gulliver's Travels, would they still function as a human being? And the answer is no, because if you get your bones and you make them in your whole body and you make it 10 times larger in every direction, that makes you 1,000 times more massive. It makes you weigh 1,000 times as much. But he realized, well, the strength of a bone is based on its cross-sectional area, which, you know, if you scale up by 10, gets 100 times larger. So 100 times stronger, 1,000 times more mass, you collapse under your own weight, which is why Spider-Man doesn't work in real life. You know, and he goes on and he describes this and he talks about a giant oak tree and a giant and so on. But Galileo provides so many illustrations in his work. I'm really disappointed that this last part he did not provide an illustration. He says, thus a small dog could probably carry on his back 2 or 3 dogs of his own size, which is adorable. But I believe that a horse could not carry even 1 of his own size, which is less adorable. So there are some symmetries, obviously, that nature seems to respect. There are others that nature doesn't. But I'm going to break a little bit with your intuition, and I'm going to introduce a symmetry, that something that seems to be almost a perfect symmetry of nature, and that is the relationship between matter and antimatter. Now, if you've ever, if you're not a scientist, and you've ever heard of antimatter, it may fill you with some sort of fear, right? Because if you know one thing about antimatter, and it shows up all the time in science fiction, it's that if you meet your antimatter twin, and you shake their hand, boom! Matter and antimatter annihilate. Antimatter seems very, very, very scary. And yet, in almost every way that matters, if every single atom in the universe were turned to its antimatter type, if every proton was turned into an antiproton, that is to say a particle with negative charge, if every electron was turned into a positron, and so forth, you'd keep living as you did before. The only problem is if half the stuff has changed to matter and half the stuff has changed to antimatter, things remain almost indistinguishable. But this raises a very, very natural question, which is you exist. That's not a question, that's a statement. You exist, statement number one. You are made of matter, statement number two. There are no antimatter people. There are no antimatter galaxies, as near as we can tell. We see galaxies collide all the time, and it would be fairly obvious to us if a matter galaxy hit an antimatter galaxy, we would know. How did matter win if matter and antimatter are essentially the laws of physics don't care which you've got? That is something of a rhetorical question. There are small differences between matter and antimatter. They show up, for example, in a particle called neutrino, and they show up in a very, very subtle way. Neutrinos are these things that are so elusive, that are so difficult to detect, that basically you need to build giant underground pools of cleaning fluid just to detect a few of them a day, and yet they're almost as abundant in the universe as photons, particles of light. So they're very, very common, but they're very, very hard to detect. And so here's the big difference between matter and antimatter. Ordinary neutrinos are always created in such a way that if you take your thumb and you take your left hand and you curl it, they're spinning around such that this is what your fingers do and this is the direction it's moving. And antineutrinos do the opposite. That's the difference. And that seems like such a ridiculous difference, right? That seems like such a minor issue. Why should that matter? And the answer is, by itself, it doesn't. But it turns out you can take this a step further. You say, oh, well, this just looks like this in a mirror. So if I took all the particles in the universe and I turned them into their antimatter type and then I looked at them in the mirror, would it be just as valid a universe as what I started? Is that a true symmetry of the universe? Do all the laws of physics respect that as a symmetry? This is, by the way, this has a fancy name. It's called CP, charge and parity. And the answer is almost. Even so, there's a very, very small difference between matter and antimatter that shows up in some fairly interesting decays. I'm not going to get into the details of it. But it turns out there's one more step that you can do where the laws of physics, if you look at the combination of symmetries, if you say, take all the particles in the universe, turn them to antiparticles, you look at everything in a mirror, and this is the one that's going to sound messed up, you run the universe, the time arrow of the universe in reverse, then the laws of physics stay the same. That it does not care. That's a perfect symmetry of nature so far as we can tell. And it's a messed up idea, but it's actually a fairly old one. This is Nobel laureate Richard Feynman in his acceptance speech, describing an idea that his thesis advisor came up with, which is that this particle of matter called antimatter called a positron, you could just think of it like an electron moving backwards in time. And just one silly way of thinking about this is it's a bit like how current goes through a wire. Electrons carry a positive charge or a negative charge, and so if they're flowing through a wire like that, it's exactly the same as if you ran it in reverse. In other words, the particles go this way, and you change the electrons to positrons. Now, here's the thing that is messed up about all of this. This combination of charge, parity, and time, that seems to be a perfect symmetry of nature. But, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, I can imagine that, you know, the thing that I call an electron, if we called that a positron, that would be no big deal. And in fact, we owe the convention that electrons have negative charges. We owe that to Benjamin Franklin. That was totally arbitrary. If we just said an electron has positive charge, everything would behave the same. If you know one thing about charged particles, it's that like charges repel and opposite charges attract. And whether the two charges are negative, they'll still repel, or if the two charges are positive, they'll repel. Same difference. That's not a problem. Saying, oh, I can imagine this universe behaving pretty much the same if I look at it in a mirror, that's not a problem. You ever go to the one of those not-so-fancy middle-brow restaurants where there's like one of those big mirrors to make it look bigger? I'm fooled into thinking that there's another room. That looks very reasonable to me. But time, reversing the arrow of time, that seems, upon first impression, that seems like totally off limits. Because there really should be a huge difference between the future and the past. So, is the arrow of time just this totally arbitrary thing? And I'll give you a short answer, which is, I don't know. Almost any experiment you can do on sort of the microscopic scale will look the same if you run it forwards or backwards. And here's just a very simple example. I can take two electrons, I can scatter them, they repel off one another. And then if I run that in reverse, take a movie, I run it in reverse, it looks perfectly fine. But on the other hand, if you go and you shoot, you break a rack of pool balls, everything will scatter. And every individual collision between the pool balls, that will look perfectly valid, whether you run it forwards or back. But there's clearly a very big difference between breaking a rack of pool balls and having them scatter and having the pool balls scatter back into a perfect triangle. Like, that latter one does not look reasonable. You know, I can give you example after example of how the future is different from the past. You remember the past, not the future, for example. And this is true on the microscopic scale, but it's not true. There's a huge difference on the macroscopic scale. Physicists understand this with the concept of entropy. This is the so-called famous second law of thermodynamics. And the idea of the second law of thermodynamics is things go from low entropy, which is another way of saying very, very high order. So if I have a bunch of air molecules, for example, in a box with a partition, they're very, very well sorted if almost all of them are in one side rather than another. That's very low entropy. High entropy, on the other hand, is when they're much more evenly distributed. And the general trend, just because there's a lot more ways to produce things with high entropy, is that things are going to move from low entropy to high entropy. This is called the second law of thermodynamics, but in fact, it really should just be the second really, really good suggestion of thermodynamics, because that happens on average because that's a much more probable, the high entropy state is a much more probable situation than a low entropy state. Our universe is moving from low entropy to high entropy. And so it leaves open the question of, does the arrow of time make things go from low entropy to high entropy? Or does the flow from low entropy to high entropy define the arrow of time? There are people who believe they know the answer. I am, I must say, quite agnostic on this point. Take it another step. So the laws of physics seem to have these symmetries to them. The universe itself seems to have a great deal of regularity to it. This is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey on the left. These are galaxies. You are at the center. Those white spaces are not places where there are no galaxies in the universe. It's just places that the survey doesn't serve. And the north side of the sky and the south side of the sky basically have as much stuff. This universe is basically the same in all directions. The right panel is the cosmic microwave background, which on average is uniformed within one part in 100,000. Very, very uniform over the universe in all directions, in all places, just as the laws of physics themselves seem to be, at least on the scales that we're able to probe. So there seem to be these wonderful symmetries on the universe itself, and so the real question is, why does symmetries matter? Why do they... You know, I've basically made a bunch of observations, and at this point you should say, isn't that interesting? But the fact is that these symmetries add up to a picture where we can start using them as explanatory of why the universe works the way it does. And we owe much of this to a mathematician you probably haven't heard of, Emmy Noether. So just to give you sort of a sense of history, she was an almost perfect contemporary of Einstein. And she had other her own problems. Einstein, as you may recall, you know, served in obscurity in a Swiss patent office until he became the Einstein you know and love. Well, her problem was prejudice against her gender. Just to put things in perspective, she wasn't allowed to study physics because going and or mathematics rather, because going to the University of Erlangen, where her father was on the freaking faculty, would overthrow all academic order. She audited her classes instead and aced her final exams at Nuremberg, basically just by sitting for the finals. She finally was able to get her PhD, but she wasn't able to get any academic position, even though it was clear to all concerned that she was one of the top minds working at the time. It wasn't until Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity that Noether's invited by Hilbert and Klein to Göttingen to sort of try to explain how it all fit together to everybody. Now, Noether was this master. She understood a huge amount about symmetry and what are called invariants. But even so, she's brought in as this guest expert. She wasn't given a pay. She wasn't given a title. She was basically a perennial guest lecturer for Hilbert, who tried to get an official position for her. You know, he has this great quote, "I don't see that the sex of the candidate is an argument against her admission as essentially an associate professor. After all, we're a university, not a bathhouse." While working there, she develops this theorem that transforms all of modern physics. So much of what we know about how the universe works owes its origin to Noether and her great theorem. So what is her theorem? Well, before we get to that, I just want to end my biography of Noether with this quote by Einstein: "The judgment of all competent living mathematicians, Noether is the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began." Einstein recognized her genius. It's sad to note, by the way, that this was his eulogy for her. She died in 1935, about a year and a half after coming to America to escape the Nazis in Europe. So what was her great theorem? Sorry to downer there. What was her great theorem? Every one of these symmetries that we talk about produces a conserved quantity. Now, conserved quantities to physicists are like catnip because they allow us to be super lazy. They basically say if you start with something, you end with the same amount of stuff. So electrical charge, you start with a certain amount of electrical charge in the universe, we believe zero. You end with a certain amount of electrical charge, zero. Energy conservation, that's another famous one. What Noether showed is that all of these things, which we might just say are curiosities, like, for example, that the laws of physics are the same everywhere in space, she proved produce a conservation of momentum. Conservation of momentum, remember, is this thing that that Newton called his first law of motion. He thought it was fundamental. Objects in motion stay in motion. Objects at rest stay at rest. That Noether basically showed, no, it's based on something more fundamental. The fact that everything's the same in all directions gave rise to the conservation of angular momentum. The fact that the laws of physics are the same in all time gave conservation to energy. An idea so fundamental, it's called the first law of thermodynamics. And she proved why it must be so. It turns out this extends further and further and further. Noether's theorem turns out to be the foundation of so much of our modern picture of particle physics and the basis of what's known as the standard model of physics that it helps to predict the existence of particles. I mean, she herself didn't do it. These were her successors. But this predicts all of the particles yet known, this beautiful picture that culminated last year with the discovery of the year before, it's January now, with the discovery of the Higgs boson. And you can see, even if I sort of display the particles in the right way, you can see even they end up producing this beautifully symmetric pattern. So symmetry, so this is sort of our point of departure. Symmetry produces all these wonderful effects about how the universe works, produces these laws that we were taught are fundamental to how the universe works. But I mentioned at the very beginning that part of the interesting thing about the universe is that there are these breaks in the symmetry. After all, we exist. We are made of matter and not antimatter. And in fact, in the very early universe, if matter and antimatter were created in perfect unison, they would have annihilated in the exact same way, and we would not be here discussing it. So the one thing I want to sort of close up with is the idea that symmetry ends up being not that interesting unless you also have ways to break symmetry. And just sort of as a visual of this, you can imagine sort of an array of countless little tops all spinning in unison. At some point, one of them is going to topple ever so slightly. Which one and in what direction? Who knows? But once it does that, once it breaks that symmetry, you're going to get this incredibly rich pattern that started from something that was initially very, very symmetric. And that is presumably the foundation of so much of what we understand to be the interesting structure in the universe, the fact that we exist, the fact that there are these bumps and wiggles in the universe that give rise to galaxies and stars and so forth, and us. So that, as I said, is my point of departure. And I've left you with a few questions, like why these symmetries and not others? How exactly are they broken? Why does the arrow of time go the way it does? As I mentioned at the beginning, one of the things that I think was very clever about Andy's selection of this particular series is I'm basically at the point where I have a lot of questions about how all of the universe is structured, and Max is going to, I hope, give us a proposal about how to reconcile some of these questions. So thank you very much.
Do you want to just use my power? Do you need the get it?
North to the dongle.
First of all, it's a great pleasure and honor to be here, and it's also a wonderfully nostalgic moment because I had four very happy years living in Philadelphia, working right next door to where Dave works over at the University of Pennsylvania. So it's awesome to be back. Thank you. Now, David showed you very beautifully here how remarkably much we humans have managed to figure out about the world. Because we've discovered all these incredible symmetries, which are a powerful example of elegant simplicity and beauty revealed by mathematical patterns in nature. There are also further examples of this, which we can talk more about, of additional patterns and regularities we've discovered. And David left you with a question, you know, why have we been so lucky? Our distant ancestors would have had a hard time in their wildest dreams to figure out that one day we'd be able to look at these little sparkling dots in the sky and figure out what they are. You know, why is it that we can figure out so much? Well, the idea that there is something intrinsically mathematical about a universe. Symmetry is being a spectacular example of that. Noether's theorem being a famous theorem of mathematics, right? It's an old idea, articulated already over 2,000 years ago by Pythagoras, who said that numbers rule our universe. And by the Renaissance, Galileo Galilei was so impressed by this that he exclaimed that nature is a book written in the language of mathematics. But where is all this math, really, that we're talking about? Okay, symmetries are mathematical, but like many of us think of mathematics as just a bag of tricks for manipulating numbers, right? And some, like my mother, think it's basically a sadistic form of torture invented by school teachers to make us feel bad about ourselves. So if I look around here in the room, I don't see any really numbers at all. Oh, here's a number, some numbers, but this was clearly just invented. Something we humans wrote there, that's not something fundamental about nature. So where is this math? Well, as we heard from Dave, nature is really full of recurrent patterns and shapes. What are these shapes called, for example? Parabolas, exactly, and they obey a very simple mathematical equation, y equals x squared, the way I've drawn it here. And they are universal in that any object you throw, if you neglect air resistance, will go in exactly this shape. If you look into space, they've mentioned that Kepler realized that everything up there orbits in ellipses, whether it's the moon orbiting around the Earth or a star orbiting around the monster black hole in the middle of our galaxy. And they obey another simple mathematical equation. And moreover, those parabolas are actually just an approximation to the ellipses because near the tip here looks a lot like a parabola. So let me ask you some more questions. We professors have this bad habit of giving pop quizzes at every opportunity. Here is one. three great discoveries: the discovery of Neptune, the discovery of the radio wave, the discovery of the Higgs boson. What tool triggered the discovery of these three things? Math, exactly. Technically, the tool was a pencil because they were all predicted through mathematics. Astronomers discovered that the planet Uranus wasn't moving quite the way it was supposed to, according to Newton's equations. And Urbain Le Verrier in France sent a letter to an astronomer named Gall in Berlin and said, hey, on such and such a date, point your telescope in such and such a place in the sky, and you will, at such and such a time, and you will there see a new planet. The guy might have thought that whoever wrote this letter was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, but you can imagine you would really have your curiosity piqued if you got such a letter. And sure enough, he looked, and boom, there was planet Neptune, predicted with math. A little bit later, James Clerk Maxwell unified all equations known about electricity and magnetism, fixed them up some, and got what we know as Maxwell's equations. This is the course I've been assigned to teach starting in 2 weeks at MIT here. And he predicted from just these equations that if you built a certain kind of device, it would be able to transmit radio waves. It would go at the speed of light, could go through empty space, through walls. It was built later, and boom, it worked. And now you all have cell phones in your pockets. More recently still, Peter Higgs sat down with the most complicated equations of physics we have so far, the so-called standard model of particle physics, and predicted that if we humans get together and build the most complex machine ever built in Geneva and crash particles together in a certain way near the speed of light, we will discover there a new particle. Do you all know what happened? We built it, boom, there it was, and he just got a free trip to visit my hometown of Stockholm as a result. So mathematics has proven to be remarkably powerful. And I just got the kind permission from my wife to actually put up these very geeky little pieces of my favorite equations at home in our living room, because I feel they really capture a lot with my little and sort of qualify as art. Some people have gone even further and put equations they discovered on their tombstones, like this photo I took of Schrödinger's grave here. So math is very powerful, and it's not just shapes and patterns and equations, it's also numbers. On the list on the right here, we have 32 numbers that I've collected together for you, with no units, just pure numbers. And these numbers have the property that from them, and the equations we discussed, we can in principle calculate every single number we've ever measured in the history of physics. All the fundamental physical constants, hundreds of thousands of properties of atoms can be calculated from these 32. It's pretty, pretty remarkable. So, by 1960, the famous physicist Eugene Wigner, whose office was very close to David Goldberg's office in Princeton, wrote an essay saying, you know, this is really weird. The enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there's no rational explanation for it. So, as Dave mentioned, in my book, I explore the range of possibilities here, because I think this is such a key question, we should let us think about it. Some people say, on one end of the spectrum, it's just a fluke, it's the way it is, let's not talk about it any further. Other people think, well, you know, maybe our universe has some mathematical properties, and then other properties which are fundamentally not mathematical. So maybe we can approximate our universe with math somehow. Again, maybe the reason is just a fluke, who knows. Then there are other people who think math is just something we invent, it's not fundamentally out there, maybe it has to do with the brain somehow. And then on the other extreme of the spectrum is an idea that I explore in quite some detail in the book, which I have a lot of sympathy for. Maybe our universe seems so mathematical because it really is. Maybe, in fact, our world doesn't just have some mathematical properties, but has only mathematical properties. So our universe isn't just described by math, but it is math, a mathematical structure. And let's talk a little bit more about this in detail, because first of all, it seems like just a ridiculous idea. After all, Let me introduce you to Mr. Hoggles, to make my point. Mr. Hoggles lives in our backyard. He mows our lawn for us. And if I look at Mr. Hoggles here and ask myself, you know, what properties does he have, this charming groundhog? Well, he has the property of cuteness, in my opinion, charm, passion for digging, herbivorousness. None of these are mathematical properties at all, right? So what do I mean when I say universe has only mathematical properties? Well, we just heard from Dave Goldberg here that we know now that Mr. Hoggles, and in fact everything else in our world, is ultimately made of elementary particles, like electrons and quarks. And what properties do they have? What properties does an electron have? It has the property minus one, one half, one, and so on. And we physicists have come up with geeky names for these properties, like electric charge, spin, and lepton number, but those are just words that we humans made up, right? The electron didn't decide that its properties were going to be called charge, and it's actually called different things in different human languages. The electron itself, the only properties it has are numbers, mathematical properties. So in that sense, the electron can be thought of as a mathematical object in the sense that it has no properties at all except mathematical properties. And the same goes for all the other basic building blocks in our world, all these other particles, that as you can see here. It's just that the numbers are different. And we heard David Goldberg tell us about antimatter. Well, if you look at the anti-electron, which isn't on my table, all the properties are the same, except that you put a minus sign in front of all the numbers, except for the number that we call mass. So, if all the stuff in space has only mathematical properties, what about space itself? What properties does empty space have? It has the property three. Three is the largest number of pencils that you can put at right angles to each other, right? Again, we've made up a geeky name for this. We call it the dimensionality of space, but it's just a number, three. Einstein then taught us that actually space has some other intrinsic properties also, known as curvature and topology, but these are also purely mathematical properties, and over at the math departments at Drexel and Penn, mathematicians study these properties. As far as we can tell, space itself has no properties at all except mathematical properties either. So if we view the fabric space as being a mathematical object, and everything in space also as having only mathematical properties, it starts to sound a little bit less ridiculous, the idea that maybe everything is mathematical. Now, what does this mean if it's the case? Well, you see I smile a lot. It's partly I blame my wife for that. But I'm generally a pretty optimistic person, and I think this is an optimistic view of the future of science and physics also, because if I'm wrong, and some properties of our world cannot be described mathematically, then we're eventually going to hit an insurmountable roadblock. There will be no more patterns for us to discover, no more symmetries, no more other regularities, and we'll be stuck. On the other hand, if I'm right, and then there is no roadblock, and everything is in principle open to our understanding, and we're only limited by our own imagination. And I think that would be very exciting if that were true. For example, consciousness. If consciousness can be understood as particles moving and beautifully complex patterns that process information, then I should be describable mathematically as well. David Goldberg talked about space and time. If you think about patterns of particles moving in space and time, then if you have a dead object like a rock where all the particles are just moving together, the shape they make is just a very boring bunch of spaghetti strands stuck together like this, right? But if you take a living object, like think of all the particles moving around in your brain as you think, they make like a beautiful braid in space-time, which is extremely complex, except vastly more complicated than this, because you have a order 10th of the 26 particles intertwined in an amazing pattern. And you know, even though we're small compared to galaxies, it's become clear, very clear, that the most complex and beautifully elaborate patterns in all of space-time that we know of in the entire universe are what you have in your own heads, your own minds. And if everything can ultimately be described by math, then there's hope that maybe even this is the mystery that we can make more progress on too. So in summary, what I've shared with you here is that we humans have repeatedly underestimated the power of our human minds to understand things. There are so many things we thought we would be forever unable to figure out, which we actually now know. And that bodes well, I think, as we look to the future at the mysteries that now confront us. And I want to encourage you all to think big. Emboldened by the ability of us humans so far to figure out how our world works and shape it for the better. And I also want you to think big in a separate, second sense, because our human potential is not the only thing we've underestimated. We've also underestimated the sheer size of the physical world around us, which is ultimately what limits our potential to do great things. Could we just turn the lights totally off for a moment here as we fly off into space? Who is the keeper of the powers of the light switch? Oh, thank you so much. So let's just head off a little bit off from the Himalayas here into space. When Eratosthenes in ancient Greece figured out the sheer vastness of the planet that we inhabit, people were extremely impressed. This was way larger than they had mostly envisioned. We now know it to be 40,000 kilometers in circumference. So this was the known world. People still had no grip on the vast, how far away the stars were. Then, using the power of our human mind, we managed to put a bunch of satellites into orbits around our planet. You see fully accurate renditions of where the near-Earth satellites are here. This great animation is made by the American Museum of Natural History. We see some geostationary satellites a bit farther out here. Everything you see here is exactly to scale. The ancient Greeks had managed to underestimate the size of our solar system by a factor of 15. So when that got corrected, poof, the size of it grew from a doll's house to an ordinary house. Now we left the moon's orbit. Soon, the orbits of the planets around the sun will start coming into view. And you all know that it takes 8 minutes for light to travel from the sun to Earth. So we see the sun the way it was 8 minutes ago. It takes hours for light to travel to the outer parts of our solar system. And so we discovered, basically, that our Earth, which was the world we knew, was just a small part of this much grander structure, the wonderful solar system. Which, in turn, we came to realize is actually just part of something even grander, slowly coming into focus now, the Milky Way galaxy. When my grandma went on her first date, we didn't know that there were other galaxies, that there even was a galaxy. That was settled only in 1925. And ask yourself, raise your hand if you know anybody who was born before 1925. Yeah, that's how recently we figured this out. So this amazing galaxy we inhabit, it's 100,000 light years from side to side, and yet it too is just part of something much grander. We heard about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey from Dave, and I also had the great fortune to get to work a lot with it in my own research, where we see that our galaxy is just one dot forming part of these clusters, this filamentary pattern of superclusters, and the Sloan Great Wall that I discovered together with my colleagues there is a billion light years from side to side. A fantastic structure, and even that's not the biggest one. All of this grandeur that we see here is actually part of something even larger, what we now affectionately refer to as our universe, or our observable universe, which is coming into focus here. Now we can get the lights on again so you don't get too cozy and comfy in your seats. And Maya, can you throw up the universe here? Thank you. This is our universe. The way we use the term in astronomy, our universe is not everything that exists. It's simply the spherical region of space from which light has had time to reach us so far during the 13.8 billion years since our Big Bang. So it's perfectly possible that if space continues out here, that there's more stuff that we cannot see, even with no matter how much money we spend on telescopes, because you might have, you would have to wait billions of years more for the light to reach us. I encourage you to play with our universe, but be careful with it and make sure it comes back here afterwards. Our universe should be treated with caution. So the vastness of our universe I just shared with you here, this sort of shows how much potential we humans have. We like to get so worked up about if our neighbor's backyard is bigger than ours or some country wants to take a little bit of space from another one. We have 10 to the power of 57 times more volume out here, okay? So let's think big. There is no known laws of physics saying that life has to be limited to stay on our planet and can't spread out and help more of our universe come alive. We also have a vast potential in terms of time. Much of the news flow is so focused on the next election cycle when in fact we have billions and billions of years ahead of us during which life can in principle do great things. So I want to spend my final minutes here just reflecting a little bit on what is it that everything we've learned in science tells us when we bring it back to home. What does it mean for us and for how we should think of ourselves in our future? We clearly have huge potential. So when we think about the road ahead here, what's around the corner? What's going to happen next? As you know, there is a wide variety of different ways this could shake out. We could either get our act together, life, we might eventually be able to seed our universe with life, and much of our universe could come alive. Or we could, there are many ways we have at our disposal for simply wiping out completely and just ending life. Maybe we could accidentally nuke ourselves. We've come pretty close to that already a few times. We could build super intelligent machines, which for some reason we don't fully understand, end up wiping us out. We might mess up our planet in various other ways. In the last part of my book, I talk about all of the most commonly discussed risks that we face as a species. And if you sort them, like I did here, by how far into the future the risk is imminent that we'll actually really get wiped out by them, you notice something very, very striking. All of the most imminent threats, which could happen very, very soon, are threats not from Mother Nature, but threats from ourselves, threats that we have created. So that what's very clear here is that if we can get our act together and avoid destroying ourselves, we'll have lots of time to use our collective creativity to take on all these other challenges. Because I can tell you, if you want in the question session, for each of these problems, very clever technical solutions that should, in principle, be able to cope with this. And I told you that David Goldberg and I, as professors, have this bad habit of loving to give pop quizzes. Well, another bad habit we have is we love just giving grades left, right, and center. As long as we do, we don't have to do the grading, I guess. So I'm going to give a grade in Risk Management 101 to humanity. Many of my colleagues feel that we should get a B+, because we've been here for a long time. We're still alive. That's pretty good, right? We didn't blow ourselves up yet, etc. But I'm actually going to give a D-. And you should know, if for truth in advertising, that I'm actually known as a very lenient grader at MIT. So I want to explain why I'm giving such a low grade here. It's because I feel we have such a huge potential that it's just totally irresponsible to keep playing Russian roulette with things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc. We don't know exactly what the probability is that we're going to go extinct in any one decade. Some people are pretty optimistic and think maybe it's 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in 10,000. Some people think it's 1 in 10. Either way, if you have billions of years at your disposal, you don't want to keep rolling the dice playing Russian roulette that often. And if I had to summarize just in one single example why I'm giving such a low grade, let it be this. There are more people on this planet who have heard of Justin Bieber than who have heard of Vasily Arkhipov. Even though the one of these two gentlemen who single-handedly prevented a Soviet nuclear attack during the Cuban Missile Crisis was actually not Justin Bieber. And I think that's pretty screwed up. Pretty screwed up priorities we have there. Okay? D-, I say. So why are we humans doing so poorly and making the most of our potential and being better stewards of our planet? Well, the number one argument I hear is, well, we just can't afford spending money on mitigating these risks. We just don't have the money. So let's look at some numbers. There are some organizations who are really working hard to reduce these risks. I talk about them in the end of my book. The Union of Concerned Scientists is probably the best funded such organization. They do a lot of wonderful stuff. Their budget is about $20 million per year. So let me shrink that down to this minusculous size. So that little area represents $20 million. Okay? Let's put this in context. Is it really true that we can't afford more? This is what we spent on cosmetic surgery last year. This is what we spent on air conditioning for U.S. troops alone, $20 billion last year. This is how much we spent smoking in the U.S. alone. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for personal choice. If someone wants to light up, you know, it's their decision, fine by me. But if someone tells me that, no, we cannot spend twice as much on the Union of Concerned Scientists on mitigating risk as humankind because it would just be such a catastrophe if we shrunk the area of this cigarette packet by that area there, don't think so. And yet they haven't even put in yet the biggest spending item, which didn't even fit on my PowerPoint. So I'm going to have to shrink this down to fit in the last year's military budget. So it's, why are we not devoting more resources towards safeguarding the future of life and preventing ourselves from going extinct? It's clearly not lack of money. Another very common argument I hear is to say, you know, it would be irresponsible for us to spend money on risks that haven't been proven. I hear that a lot. Now, to see the logical flaw in this argument, I want you to imagine that you're in a store shopping for a stroller for the baby of a really good friend of yours. And this slick salesman comes up to you and says, hey, you know, I have two models. I have this one for $49.99. It's a very robust and solidly designed stroller. We've sold it for over 10 years. There have never been any reports of any kind of problems with it. But then, I have this model here for only $39.99. And you know, yeah, I know there have been some news reports of it sometimes collapsing and crushing the child. And you know, but honestly, there's been really no one has been able to really substantiate these claims, and at least nobody's been able to ever prove in court that any of these injuries were actually due to design flaws in the stroller. And it's 20% cheaper. Which one are you going to buy? So, if someone tells, so of course you're thinking to yourself, it's just not true that it's irresponsible to spend money, to spend 20% more on risks that aren't proven, because it would be irresponsible to not spend money on risks unless we can prove that those risks are not dangerous, right? But if that's how we feel when the life of one child is at stake, surely we should feel the same way if the life of all children on the planet are at stake. Not to mention the lives of all future generations of children who might exist during the next hundreds of thousands, millions, and maybe even billions of years. Because that's the full magnitude of the potential that we stand to obliterate if we screw up here. So when we look ahead and ask ourselves, what should we devote our resources to? I feel it's really worth taking the cosmic perspective, thinking big, and realizing how amazing the potential really is that we stand to squander it and try to be better stewards of our planet. And in summary, to conclude it all, I'm encouraging you to think big. We've proven ourselves to be the masters of underestimation, we humans. We've underestimated again and again the size of everything. And we've underestimated again and again our ability to understand our universe, underestimated the power of our human minds. So although we're small, you know, we humans have a great power to understand and improve the world around us. So let's make a difference.
I could see that hands are up already. We only have about 15 minutes, so please refrain from pontificating. Keep it terse, and we'll get through some of these questions. Gentlemen in front.
If we reach deep space beyond the Oort cloud, and there's just basically dark energy, maybe dark matter, dark energy, is it possible, do you think, that we'll discover, sort of like in the movie Contact, I think it was, that we can actually travel with no mass other than our own mass, we could travel instantaneously great distances?
Sure, sure. Even leaving aside the possibility that we might in the future discover more clever ways of traveling even faster, even if we just use the physics we know, where we're limited to going near the speed of light, there is absolutely nothing in the laws of physics that prevents us from ultimately colonizing our galaxy if we're willing to be patient. And it's a pretty common assumption, I find, among people to assume that just because there's so many stars out there, there's got to be civilizations and life everywhere, which I think we have to be very careful to not take as an excuse for being sloppy and careless with our own planet, figuring, oh, we can screw up here because there's life elsewhere. They're going to sort it out anyway. What we do doesn't really matter. I think we have found now in recent, especially in the last decade, right, we've gone from having 8 planets, sorry, Pluto, to knowing about more than 1,000 planets. We know that there are many, probably billions of planets, even in our own galaxy, which are just as inhabitable as Earth, yet at least 2 billion years older. So if it were really likely to get life on all these planets, it's very hard to understand why all of those billions of civilizations independently would have decided to just sit and meditate, and none of them would have come here and colonized us or something like that. So we should be open to the idea, I think, at least, that life as we know it might be very rare. And if it is, that should make you feel very significant, I feel, because we might feel small because we're physically small, but if you look at these galaxies that we flew around in and you feel that they're beautiful, why are they beautiful? It's because you are conscious of them. Right? If there were nobody there with telescopes seeing them, they would just be a giant waste of space, as far as I'm concerned. And if we manage to one day get our act together and spread life out into the cosmos, and most of our universe becomes alive, of course, we can't predict what our ancestors, what our descendants are going to think of us. But I'm sure they're not going to think of us as insignificant.
So I just wanted to add one point. So Max gave a very optimistic view, which is as we travel out, sort of thinking in the optimistic future, thankfully the Borg are not just waiting for us outside our immediate horizon. But there is actually another little advantage as well. You mentioned, we need to be patient. But one of the great things is if we ever do develop the technology to travel at speeds close to the speed of light, one of the great things is your internal clock and every clock on the ship slows down. So you don't even need to be that patient. It's effectively true. Like you're in suspended animation. So there's a lot of cause for optimism. Because this is a happy occasion to talk about all the optimistic sides of things, I don't want to focus too much on the insane energy requirements for actually traveling to another star in a reasonable amount of time. But they are formidable.
Another question. Yeah, right here in the second row.
So far, at least, physics has been largely a reductionist activity, and I think the discovery of fundamental symmetries bears that out. But I'd like you to talk about complexity. I mean, is all complexity, can it be reduced to simplicity? And I'm talking about physics, and perhaps even humans, as you were talking about.
Say something about that? That's a great question. So I feel, and I think David agrees with me, that many of the greatest breakthroughs in physics have involved unifications. And many of the ideas that turned out to be wrong were ideas that said that X is separate from Y. We heard beautifully from David Goldberg here how people used to think that on one hand there were symmetries, on the other hand there were conservation laws. And Minato showed us, no, it's unified. We used to think there was matter and energy. Einstein unified it. We used to think there was space and time. Einstein unified it. We used to think there was gravitation and acceleration. Einstein unified it. We used to think there was electricity and magnetism. You know, Maxwell unified it. And so if you now look at this traditional dualistic view of consciousness and mind, it feels very similar to me. Philosophers have argued for so long that on one hand there's the physical world, it's you and your quarks moving around in these elaborate patterns. On the other hand, there's this inner world, the movie in your head, the wonderful feeling that there's an I in there perceiving it, and that's somehow different. I think it's much more likely that, again, this too will be unified. These are just two very different and both legitimate ways of thinking about the same thing. And just to make yourself feel better about who you are, I know some people don't like to feel that they're a heap of quarks. Another very powerful idea in physics is the one of emergence or substrate independence. There are so many properties in nature, like waves, for instance, where what's really important about the wave is not what kind of particles it's made out of. Because you can have waves in all sorts of different media. If you look at waves in the ocean, the water molecules, they're not even moving. They're just mostly bobbing up and down. Yet the wave can travel for thousands and thousands of meters, you know. And if you think of not a wave but a computer program running, now it doesn't matter for the computer program if it's running on Windows or Mac OS. What matters is the higher level. The substrate on which it's running is rather unimportant, and I suspect it's going to. If we ever understand consciousness, we'll come to the same insight that your quirks don't actually matter so much. It's the patterns of information processing in your mind, the higher level things going on, which is what you call your thoughts, which is your inner world. That's what really matters, and it's actually relatively independent of the details of the quirks because you could have that same wonderful phenomena on other physical substrates too. That's how I see it all being unified.
Yeah. So I want to just add a couple of points. You know, physicists are very famous for suffering from this disease, where we basically come across as universal experts on every field, including, you know, biology, chemistry, doesn't matter, economics. Physicists will hold forth on anything if you give us enough time. I would not presume at this point to say that physicists are necessarily going to be the ones who give any great insight into consciousness or how the brain works. I will simply make the observation that there's sort of two questions, there's two competing questions here. One is, do we believe that there is a, I would normally say, purely physical, but in fact, you know, sort of thinking about it in the light of Max's talk, a purely mathematical description that we just don't know about? And the answer to that, I believe, based on every other step that we've ever discovered, is yes. And then there's the other question of, do we now or will we in the near future be able to discern where that all comes from? And those are separate questions. So the answer to that may well be no. That may well be never. But I take a page out of your optimist book about the potential of humanity and say, well, I hope that we do.
Just to add to that excellent point, which I completely agree with, among all the other isms that philosophers like to talk about, the dualism and this ism and that ism, there's also defeatism, where if you have as a starting principle that this particular phenomenon, you know, consciousness, for instance, is in principle impossible for us humans to understand, then you're not going to try to understand it, and that is the best way to guarantee failure, to talk yourself into the, oh, we can never do it, so then let's not bother. If we're going to fail at something, I'd much rather go down swinging.
Let's keep swinging here. There's a gentleman in a tie with, yeah, right there.
I have a question about the idea of the mathematics, the world is mathematics, and it has to do with indeterminacy. And it's not the quantum probability that does obviously follows mathematical patterns, but underneath that, the deep indeterminacy, is there mathematics in that?
That's a great question. We talk a lot about in the seventh and eighth chapters of the book. As you said, if you look at the world the way a student studying the Schrödinger equation of quantum mechanics does, then it's completely deterministic. There's this thing called the wave function, which is, in a sense, moving around in this space called Hilbert space, which was invented by this very sympathetic fellow that understood the genius of Edmund Noether, we heard about, and just moving around, doing its thing, always one, was one, always will be one. But the way it's perceived by us, self-aware entities who can only be aware of a tiny fraction of this Hilbert space, is instead as one where sometimes random things seem to happen. And I talk about in the book how even if there were no quantum mechanics, if you just went down to one of the nice hospitals here in Philadelphia and made a perfect clone of yourself, and you put one clone in room one, one in room two, and someone bets you $100 that you're going to wake up in room two, you would give them 50-50 odds, because both copies of you are going to wake up in some room. There's no way for you to predict when you wake up which one of them you are. So cloning, totally deterministically, feels like subjective randomness. And what the Schrödinger equation says, if you take it really literally, is just that nature is busy cloning. The Schrödinger is busy cloning you all the time, even when you're not aware of it. And that's why things sometimes feel random. So in that sense, you can actually reconcile the apparent randomness with a true underlying mathematical order.
So I was going to let Max have this question all to himself, as it was directed in his book. But I did want to add one thing, because I suppose I disagree in some sense. So the question, the original question, sort of gets to a very fundamental problem in quantum mechanics, which is this idea of the collapse of the wave function, as it's called. So we talk about this wave function, you know, which is deterministic. There's nothing in the Schrödinger wave equation that tells you that, you know, the classic example is that you measure a spin of a particle and you can measure it up or down. And Max brought up the specific examples. We're conscious beings. I think a lot of people don't necessarily think that consciousness has that much to do with how things perceive, whether the wave function collapses and how. And in fact, it really is an unsolved problem of how exactly nature picks one state or another. There's this very famous thought experiment, the Schrödinger's cat. The idea, you know, you, very sadistic sounding. You know, you put a cat in a box with a radioactive decay, and if the thing decays in a certain period of time, cat is killed. And the question is the cat dead or alive? And according to one interpretation of quantum mechanics, it's completely indeterminate until a human being basically opens the box and collapses the wave function and finds it dead or alive. And in between, it's sort of 50-50. It's this, you know, wave function of that. It is important to mention, and I think in many ways not a lot has changed since then, that Schrödinger was making fun of this interpretation. He did not actually suggest this as an experiment, and he didn't actually think that this is the way that we should think of the universe, even though it was his own thought experiment.
That's right, and David brings up a very good point here. Your question is such a good question that the world's top physicists still agree on it. In fact, last week I organized a conference where we took a poll among those present, and about half of them voted for this many worlds interpretation, which simply says that the wave function never collapses. And then the other half of them thought, no, it's in some different way, or we don't know. So it's a question that is very much at the forefront of research. And I want to emphasize just one other very important thing, too, because when you first hear about this, it just sounds like pure philosophy, which can never be tested. After all, people have argued about this for almost 100 years now, and they're still arguing, right? But this might change, because what the many worlds interpretation, what Hugh Everett, when he came up with this, first said, is simply that this one equation, Schrödinger's equation, always holds. And no exceptions, no collapse. And what that means is if you look at the multi-million-dollar effort right now to build large quantum computers, the NSA loves it and they want to use it to crack your codes, among other things. If that ultimately fails, because one discovers that there is this wave function somehow does collapse inside of those quantum computers despite all the best efforts to prevent it from doing so, that shows that Everett was wrong, and all those parallel universes aren't there, right? On the other hand, if this succeeds, if we can build a quantum computer which can calculate something which a normal computer would take more than the age of our universe to do, and it can do that by effectively harnessing the power of all those parallel worlds to get the answer faster in the ultimate parallel computation, That would convince a lot of physicists that actually those parallel worlds are real. So parallel universes are not a theory. Right? They're just a prediction from certain theories. In this case, the Schrodinger equation, if you take it seriously and say there's not allowed to be an asterisk there saying sometimes it's not valid when, you know, when someone observes. That's something one can test, and it is being tested now, and it's going to be just really cool to see what happens with this technology, if it works or not.
In a parallel universe, we would have more time to continue this discussion. Unfortunately, we've hit our cap. So thank you very much for joining us. Please thank Max Tegmark and Dave Goldberg. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.